This fall, the Midwest Center for Holocaust Education was preparing for a big milestone, the celebration of their 25th anniversary. The entire Jewish community here in town was gearing up to honor the families who'd been telling their stories since 1993. The event was scheduled for October 28th. On October 27th, just the day before, a gunman entered a synagogue in Pittsburgh and committed an act of violence that shook communities all over the country, including here. The incident was obviously on people's minds as they gathered and remembered history in a slightly more ominous light than they might have hoped. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and with a Washington Post poll revealing that up to 22% of millennials aren't sure what the Holocaust was, we're talking about the challenge facing the descendants of survivors. What's the best way to preserve the memories and lessons of a really painful past? My first guest is Steve Cole. His parents were Holocaust survivors. They fled Germany in 1938, and it's a story I know well because Steve is also my step-uncle. Hi, Uncle Steve.
Hi, Gina.
So you're here today because you just got back from a trip to Germany. On that trip, you were commemorating Kristallnacht. Can you explain that? What was Kristallnacht and why were Jewish people returning to Germany in remembrance?
Kristallnacht was literally the translation of the Night of Broken Glass. And on November 9th, 1938, after 5 years of, we'll say, escalating political oppression and isolation, and the Jewish community faced for the first time a mass physical uprising that resulted in Jewish storefronts having all their glass windows broken out, the synagogues being burned to the ground, the cemeteries being turned over, and things like that. And that happened to be the very night that my mother left Germany 80 years ago.
You know, I have, since meeting your mother, heard the story of that history always through her experience. And I wonder if you can tell the story that way.
I can only tell it that way because it's hand-me-down information from her. Basically, my mother and her family on my maternal grandfather's side had lived in the same small town in Germany for hundreds of years, and it was very easy to prove their history back in that community back to 1750. And zipping forward as quickly as possible, in World War I, her father and a number of their her uncles served in the German army. Two were killed in World War I, fighting for the Kaiser. Two were awarded medals of honor. And then 20 years later, all these people were told they were not German citizens anymore, that they should leave. And then it became life-threatening. And on that particular night, the story is that my mother was in her home, and the rabble came outside the house, and they yelled up to my grandfather, "Are you a Jew?" And he said, "Yes." And they said, "Well, in 10 minutes, we're going to burn your house down." And with that, my mother folded up her belongings that she'd been preparing, and she left.
Yeah, she had already gotten tickets to leave. And if I remember right, there's also a story of like a day or so between when she left her home and when she could actually get on the boat.
You know, there's a progression there. As she left Geilenkirchen, which is in the northwest corner of Germany, very close to the Holland border, literally walking distance, the next biggest city was Cologne. And so she had to go to Cologne, Germany, in order to make her way to, I think it's Bremen, to get on the boat that went to England and then on to the United States. So there was some time passed
where she had to pretend that she was not a Jew.
So she certainly had to suppress it, right. And so, you know, the story there was that as having run out of Geilenkirchen, then she was attempting to get a hotel room, and it said Jews are not welcome, and trying to get dinner, and the Jews are not welcome. But luckily she didn't, particularly as she likes to say, look ethnically Jewish. So it was relatively easy for her to get acceptance and get in somewhere.
And she's how old at this point?
22.
And the moment, you know, when they're given the warning, in 10 minutes, we're going to burn your house down, she folds up her belongings and leaves. But she's also saying, she's saying goodbye to her parents forever.
I
or
have,
no?
Well, I don't think it was fully understood at that point, and there was an opportunity later in which she was able to reconnect for just a few minutes or something with her father, but not her mother. So I don't know if she actually articulates that she knew she was never coming back right then, but she was certainly heading away.
So it's been 80 years since then, and Jewish families with stories much like yours are in pretty large numbers going back to Germany. Why?
Well, I can't speak to that. There are large numbers. I'm aware of some. There's a whole bunch of the community that says we want nothing to do with Germany and any of that ever again. So I would not want to paint with that broad a brush. But of the people I know who have gone back, I think it's a choice between completely forgetting your history or capturing it. I was there because there's a gentleman there who's done an exceptional job of researching the five Jewish families of his small town and providing family trees and all the rest of it. And I wanted to capture that information, and we coordinated that. I wanted to capture the history.
Were you at all nervous about what you might learn and the feelings it might bring up to actually be there? Because something that I've noticed is when you know these stories and you tell them again and again, the telling helps you in some ways develop a little bit of a protective callus. Like, this is the way I tell this story. This is the information that's included. I know this story. It's painful, but I can get through this story. When you go and learn more information, it kind of opens that all back up.
Most people get to the point you're talking about. For some reason, certain parts of this topic always make me emotional again. However, I had the advantage. I had been to Geilenkirchen 2 years prior. And so we had interacted with some of the history, seen the locations and things like that. And I left 2 years ago, sure that I never wanted to go back to Germany again. It made me uncomfortable. But
wait, can you describe that more? Made you uncomfortable?
The stories had gone on all of my life, so to speak, and then to go back and see a physical presence and be at a building that certainly wasn't my family's home because that had long been destroyed, but in a location that was that, and to go into the cemetery and see the familiar last name going back and back and back into history, so it made it more tangible than it had been previously.
Okay, so that had made you uncomfortable, but a couple years later, you're then thinking about it again.
Well, it became a point of I had to go capture this information to make sure I understood it correctly. And then there are some school students who had used my family's case or my mother's case as the basis of their own study of the Holocaust. They had won the Chancellor's Award on a national competition based upon the information that they got about my family and my mother. And I wanted to acknowledge them. And a university nearby in Aachen, which is the next biggest city, also had a program that they ran for a year in which the subject matter was basically what happens at the intersection of religion and government. And again, they drew upon our history and this gentleman's resources. And the finale of that, the display of that, was coming up the week prior to Kristallnacht. So we coordinated so I could get my information, participate with these students, and ultimately participate in Geilenkirchen Community's Kristallnacht commemoration itself. And that was a stunning event.
Tell me about it.
Well, I had been asked the night before whether I would be willing and able to speak at this. Now, I don't speak any German, so I didn't know exactly what they meant. But fortunately, a great number of the Germans speak English, so that got that burden off my shoulders. And I sat there for a minute, and I couldn't decide whether I was more obligated on behalf of my family and parents to speak or whether they would prefer I was not here at all. I had never resolved that. And so I decided I would speak. And so what happened is I went to this unbelievable ceremony. And this took place in the central Protestant church of this town of a few thousand people. The priest of the Catholic Church and the reverend of the Protestant church worked this together. I was informed that 2 years ago they had 80 attendees. Last year they had 100 attendees. This year they had over 200 attendees. And they made a very somber presentation. Would you want me to summarize it?
Yeah.
A translator was provided for me, and he was from Wisconsin, and he was in the community teaching English. So he stood by my side and translated. And what he basically told me is that the Reverend said 80 years ago, our grandparents made a horrible mistake and committed a sin. And we inherited that sin, and it's our obligation to continue to remember what occurred and to take actions to make sure it doesn't happen ever again. And so we keep this alive. And this was the most astounding thing to me, because I'm in this all-German Protestant church. There's a big crucifix on the wall, and right at that moment, a blue Star of David lights up on their bima. It was visually stunning. And continued on just for a second, you know, they said things like, we have to remember that they use a phrase, our former Jewish, lost former Jewish citizens, okay, our lost former Jewish citizens are the foundation of our Christian faith. And, you know, my head went back. I was just stunned. And then they led us a procession from there, carrying blue and white balloons, up to the cemetery. And at the cemetery is where I spoke.
What did you say?
That was a real difficult ad hoc kind of a thing. And I said, basically, your leadership, political and religious, has made a point to keep the memory of what happened here alive. You've heard the stories, you've studied it. And I said, for what I can do, I'll try to make it real for you. And I told again the story of the rabble outside my parents' home and the suffering that they had had up to that point. And basically at the end, I said, nothing more can be done about what has occurred. We just have to make sure that we make a point to remember it always and treat each other with love and respect and go forward. I said, you know, you're standing here in the cemetery of my family going back hundreds of years. And until 1933, my family was integrated completely into the society. They would have had your grandparents as friends. They all did business together. And then all of this happened. And that shows you how quickly things can change.
The timing right after Pittsburgh must have made this just so intense, more even than it already would have been.
Well, I took my niece, Emily Loeb, with
me. My stepsister.
Yes, absolutely. And Emily lives in Pittsburgh, and she had brought with her one of the Pittsburgh Strong shirts that showed that the Steelers adopted, where they had a Star of David in place of one of the little diamonds on the Steelers logo. And we gave a couple of those out. And it was a very stunning thing. And the people in Germany, in this very small town, were still very conscious of what had happened in Pittsburgh.
I mean, I'm curious for you, when you think about the future of how people learn about this. I mean, you were giving this speech in Germany, but what do you think about what people know about the Holocaust here? And particularly like school-age kids up through kids the age of yours, who are, I guess, young adults now.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the Jewish community, we're very sensitive to it, and my family specifically, as are our other people who have survivors of all kinds. But, you know, I'm active in the Midwest Center for Holocaust Education, and our mission is to keep this subject alive and in front of people as they go through high school, particularly. And make sure that they're made aware of it. We're trying to keep it very much tangible to them.
How well do the school groups you encounter already know the story of the Holocaust? I mean, growing up a generation ago, learning about the Holocaust generally meant hearing a survivor speak at some point or another and seeing a person's facial expressions as they remembered, things like that. That is. It seems like that would be, on some level, irreplaceable.
Well, fortunately, the Midwest Center for Holocaust Education produced a number of, I'm not sure if you call them audio or visual studies or oral histories. So my mother is one of many people who had these recorded, and I'm able to produce a DVD and put it on the screen for the students to hear in her own words what happened, as opposed to just me relaying it.
You know, you have three kids. They're now grown or close to it. And I wonder if you can say more about whether they hold these memories in a different way. And if so, What is the difference between third generation and second generation?
Well, I think any time passes, things get watered down and something moves into history. But in my family, I'm fortunate that our children are very sensitive to the subject material. Some talk about wanting to continue on this work that I do as a second generation speaker into the third generation. You know, we have to keep the subject alive.
It is hard, though, because on the one hand, healing means letting go of something a little, but I'm not sure what it is, because you don't want to let go of the information. You don't want to let go of the empathy and the emotional undercurrent of all that information. You don't want to let go of the humanity of it. How do you transmit the memory without transmitting the trauma with it?
I don't know. This is a very interesting question. It's a matter of great introspection for me. I'll just paint it out as somewhere between on a spectrum that says we need to not dwell in this. Is the offsetting side is it's been predominant in my upbringing all of my life. And I certainly can't forget about it and honor my family. And then there's that old adage of if you forget the past, you're doomed to repeat it. So I guess basically we're forced to carry the burden forward.
In just a minute, we'll bring in a local teacher who isn't Jewish. She's taking this up in her classroom, and she joins this discussion after the break. You can, too, at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. We're talking about remembering the Holocaust, why it matters, and what some of the challenges are. I'm Gina Kaufman. Back in a minute. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about the future of history, I guess you could say, when it comes to the Holocaust specifically. It's been 80 years since Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass. And, you know, before Kristallnacht, a Jewish person or family trying to flee Germany could maybe still just go. After that, things took a different turn. And in the course of commemorating that event, the shooting at a synagogue in Pittsburgh was a sobering reminder of why it matters to learn from history. But according to a poll in the Washington Post, up to 22% of millennials don't know for sure what the Holocaust even was. My guest so far has been Steve Cole. His parents were Holocaust survivors. He tells their story for the Midwest Center for Holocaust Education. Hi again, Steve.
Hi there.
Our next guest is a teacher, Jenny Buchanan. She's with us from the Blue Valley District. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So teaching the Holocaust is important to you, but not because it's a personal story like it is for Steve. Can you talk about why it's important to you and where your interest in this comes from?
Right. I started studying the Holocaust in my master's program and noticed that students in general were very engaged and very curious about the Holocaust, as I was as well, and wanted to study something that not only intrigued me, but that I knew students would also benefit from. And I think it's great for students to engage in a topic where they can see not only the worst that humans can do to each other, but also what humans can do to help each other as well in the long run. And I think that it really builds a lot of opportunities for students.
Can you talk a little bit about your journey from an intellectual interest to maybe the more human side of it?
Can you clarify?
Yeah. Well, I just, it seems like you started out with the idea that something was intriguing and engaging.
Mm-hmm.
And it, as far as I understand it, did you have some travel that that sort of changed how you felt about it or connected you in a different way?
Right. My travel did come after I finished my master's degree. The travel came after, this was around 2009 that I went to Poland. So it was about 8 years after I finished my master's degree. But through my program, I started volunteering at Midwest Center for Holocaust Education through their Isaac Fetterman teaching cadre. And then I applied and did a teacher fellowship program at the United States Holocaust Museum. And through that was invited by the Polish government to engage in a summit of Polish teachers and also American teachers to talk about how we approach Holocaust education differently. So through that study, I was able to not only learn from colleagues, Polish colleagues and American colleagues, but also to see firsthand Auschwitz and the Warsaw Ghetto and other locations in Poland.
Can you talk a little bit about the things you learned? Like what, when you had this gathering of basically international experts talking about how you teach the Holocaust, what were some of the big questions people wrestled with, some of the big issues that you delved into?
What we did was we, in general, taught a lesson to each other that we teach to our students. So it was a lot of gaining information of how do you appropriately teach a specific topic, what's the pedagogy that you focus on with the students. What was very apparent is that the Polish people were very sensitive about the topic, that they did not want to be perceived that this was their Holocaust. They believed that because they were occupied by Germany, that they wanted this to become a part of more German history that happened in our land, and that they were the victims as well. So that was an interesting perspective that I gained from that opportunity.
Did you, when you talk about sensitivity, what about, you know, when you're teaching in the United States, high school age kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're teaching this history that for some people could be very like emotionally triggering. How do you teach the sort of, I guess, different audiences in your classroom?
Yes, it's very different depending on even which school that you teach in. I used to teach in the Lee Summit district, very few Jewish families in that district, and now teach in the Blue Valley School District where I have more Jewish students. And so that's an interesting dynamic too, of being able to pull from family history as well, and being able to
pull. So you involve the students?
If possible, yes, absolutely. Yes, and even in Lee Summit, I had a student who was from Bosnia, and her family lived through the Bosnian genocide, and her father was killed in a shooting. And we watched Schindler's List after school for extra credit. And it was very interesting to watch her reaction. She didn't know it would trigger the emotions that it did within her in seeing a shooting, and she had to leave the classroom. So even sometimes you don't know who you have in your classroom and how it's going to affect them. So yes, it differs.
You've been teaching for 23 years, right?
Yes.
Have students been coming to the classroom with a different, like, pre-existing sense of what happened in the Holocaust and attitude toward it? Has that changed?
I believe that the biggest change that I saw was moving school districts. When I was in Lee Summit, I felt like students came to my class saying, I know everything there is to know about the Holocaust. You really can't teach me anything differently. And my approach is always, your knowledge is probably middle school knowledge, and we at US sophomores, we can approach this in much more of an in-depth way. So there was definitely a sense of Holocaust fatigue in those classrooms where kids felt like we've done this every year, we rehash the same information. And when I moved to the Blue Valley School District, I noticed a little bit of a difference. They have realigned the curriculum where, for the most part, it's only in the eighth grade language arts classroom. And very...
Language arts, that's interesting.
Yes, yes. They do more of a novel and memoir study there. So most of the classrooms spend, I believe, I can't say for sure, but I want to say it's around a couple of months in the eighth grade year on the Holocaust. So it's very much more of a narrative study. And the teachers do cover the history, but on the high school level, it's drastically shortened because there's the belief that, oh, well, they got this time period in eighth grade.
Steve, what do you think about the use of memoir as the way into studying the Holocaust, learning what the Holocaust was and what happened?
if it's actual memoir and it's accurate, it's got to be useful.
Do you have concerns about accuracy?
Yeah, there are certain subjects, certain books and things that are presented often that maybe don't portray the situation accurately. I haven't read it myself, but The Boy in the Striped Pajamas is a frequent book used as by the teacher saying, this is what we're doing to study the Holocaust. And while I haven't read the book, I have an understanding that it's a highly sanitized, romanticized, and unrealistic view of what happened. So if people get their basis of the Holocaust from that, they could be missing
from a feel-good story.
I don't want to call it a feel-good story again because I haven't read it, but yeah. It's certainly not, by reputation, not as intense as the subject matter actually was.
Jenny, are you familiar with this one?
Yes, yes. It's a movie that a lot of students watch, and I hear a lot of students say, oh, I love that movie. You know, that's what engaged me in my study of the Holocaust. And I do have to clarify to them that it's fiction and there are flaws, quite a few flaws in that story. So try to redirect them to more memoirs and firsthand accounts instead.
So this does bring up then again the idea that the presence of survivors is so much of how we learn through firsthand accounts. And it sounds like the Midwest Center for Holocaust Education has done a lot to preserve local stories. But is this a concern? Is this like a larger concern about the firsthand transmission of stories and that we won't have that forever?
Well, I think the Midwest Center has done a magnificent job of capturing the first-person stories and preserving them and making them available in modern formats. I think it was originally on DVDs, and I think they can be streamed now. And they used to have to ship boxes to the teachers who were studying things, and now they can make all the materials available online. And so I'd like to think that the first-person stories are preserved.
Let's talk to some of our listeners. We've got calls at 816-235-2888. Al is calling from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Al. Al, are you there? Okay, we'll go back to Al. I was just, you know, when I think about the first person story, I guess the reason that I keep coming back to that, I remember being about 10 or 11, and a local guy, I think he wrote a book called Growing Up in the Holocaust, and that was given to all of us in school, and he came and talked to us. And after he spoke, he told his own story, but then, and he told it in a pretty contained kind of way. He kept his composure through his story. It was a really difficult story. He was actually in a concentration camp, and at the end of the story, though, he opened it up to questions. And when people started asking questions that sent him back into parts of the memory that he was not used to telling, he cried. And it was for a group of kids to see this transformation in him. I think the kind of empathy that comes from that experience, it's hard to imagine anything comparing to that. And I guess that's true for a lot of different experiences in history.
When you watch my mother's video, and I've seen some of the other survivors' videos as well, when you watch them, they're polished and they're not too terribly emotional. They pretty much lay out what happened and tell the story as faithfully as possible. But when the people have to tell it personally, how can they not convey the emotional impact of what happened? And, you know, the range in how people dealt with their experiences in the Holocaust is very broad. Some people came out of it barely able to function. Some people came out of it with a great zest for life. In the middle were other people who, I want to say, got on with the day as well as they could.
Yeah. Let's try again with our phone calls. I'm going to go to Michael in Ottawa, Kansas. Hi, Michael.
Hi. excuse me. A question for your guests. Do you think that the Holocaust will ever be remembered in an annual memorial service the way Passover remembers events in Egypt, maybe Kristallnacht becoming a memorial or something like that, the way Christmas is, for instance, in Christianity, a memorial event?
Well, Michael, that's a good question, but the things you're making reference to are largely religious holidays, and they're all presented on good merits for what they represent in the Bible and through history. Kristallnacht and the Holocaust are commemorated with societal remembrances. They have a Yom HaShoah remembrance throughout the world, and I certainly know we do in Kansas City every year. And there's a couple of other events that commemorate specifically what happened. And there was one here just recently, not only on the anniversary of Kristallnacht itself, but then, of course, the Monday after the Pittsburgh shooting, there was a very large community gathering in which 3,000 people attended from all faiths and backgrounds to show solidarity.
And so the idea of a societal commemoration being also one that is shared between Jews and non-Jews.
Yeah, I don't think there's any particular motion to make that happen. If you want to say a national holiday or something like that, no, I don't. I've never heard that suggested.
Let's go ahead and go back to Jenny. Jenny, I mean, what do you see as sort of how have you approached? You've created a whole program, right, for teaching about the Holocaust?
Yes, a unit. Yes.
Can you describe it?
I really focus at the beginning of my unit on anti-Semitism. I believe that I shouldn't say a lot of teachers, but it's sidestepped by quite a few teachers, and they generally jump into more of concentration camps and more of the gore that they feel like is going to suck the students in. But I always start with anti-Semitism because I believe that that's where students are really curious. They're generally the first question that they ask me is, why does everybody hate the Jews? And I, of course, have to take a second and say, first of all, not everyone hates the Jews. But yes, let's go back in time and let's talk about where this started and how it has proceeded over time. And then we do go into more of the progression of the Holocaust, that this was not an act that just happened.
Well, Steve Cole, Jenny Buchanan, thank you both so much.
Thank you
for the opportunity to participate.
The Midwest Center for Holocaust Education, based here in Kansas City, is celebrating its 25th year, and 2018 also marks 80 years since Kristallnacht in Germany. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for more Central Standard, this time with a local author. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now I'm here with the Kansas author Molly Krause. She wrote a memoir titled Float On about losing her dad to AIDS in the early days of that epidemic. So it's a big story, but it's also a personal story of her relationship with her dad, with her unconventional family, and with herself. And it takes place split between Topeka and New York. Molly Krause, hello.
Hello.
Can you tell the story that the book opens with, the story of the ashes?
The ashes, yes. So, my father was cremated, and we never really did anything with his ashes initially. I think probably for lots of reasons, but some of the fatigue and emotion around his death. And so when we decided I wanted to finally, decades later, do something to sort of commemorate my father's passing, I decided to get some jewelry made from his ashes, which is actually a thing. And that's what I write about in the book. If you do a Google search of such things, you'll find a wide variety of things possible. What I realized is that we couldn't find the ashes. And There's since been development on that, actually. But the book opens with the fact that we could not find his ashes at that point, decades later.
And that it seemed really fitting to you, it sounds like, that he was thwarting your plans.
Yes, exactly. I'm like, isn't this typical? That's right. We were going to do this, but he was going to, in the end, he'd have his own way with it. But yes, the addendum to that story is not about 6 months ago, my mom found the ashes, which was kind of funny because it reminds me of the fact that, I didn't realize until I became a mother that the reason why my own mom could find things is because she's really the only one who ever looked, you know? And so they did actually turn up in the end, and we did get the jewelry made out of it, and it was beautiful.
Well, so what inspired you to want to write this story? Which I should say, it is about your dad and your relationship with him, but it's also got other really significant threads that I want to tell as well today. What was it that inspired you?
Well, I think my love of memoir as a genre and as a reader, I think ultimately inspired me to try to tell my story. I realized when I was, a grown woman that I hardly ever talked about a lot of the events in this book. And they're big events, and they were unique, and I decided that I wanted to try to tell it from a writing perspective and also as a growth perspective. I realized I'd been hiding some of this stuff, and I really didn't want to do that anymore. I kind of felt done with feeling shame over some of these issues, and I thought that maybe, I could give back in the area of memoir in the same way that I've received so much from other people's memoirs.
So this memoir really begins with a small moment, but a telling one, a memory of a car ride with your dad. He was this grown-up, and it becomes very quickly clear, a grown-up you barely knew. And you seemed, even as a child, to wrestle with how to be around him, with this confusion about the intimacy you felt like maybe you should feel, knowing that this was your dad, and then this reality that you didn't know each other.
Yes. It really is one of my earliest memories of being around my dad. And what is notable about it is I felt incredibly awkward after having spoken in a sort of transparent way, being myself. And I felt like I shouldn't have even spoken. And so, that was very telling of our intimacy, which I didn't know him. And that lasted for a long time. And it really wasn't until he became ill and our family, kind of transitioned into taking care of sick dad.
Your father was gay, and it sounds like you did not actually know that quite at the same time as he did and your mom did. It sounds like you actually kind of learned about that as a passing note in a family therapy session.
That is correct. Yes. I found out really in middle school. And one thing I appreciate about writing the story when I did as an adult, and that kind of ties into, I really liked listening to your last guests talk about family history and, why we do what we do. And I realized I can appreciate my mom more at the time, some of her background of not wanting to talk about it as much because it felt pretty secretish. That was the culture. And part of it was a different day. And she felt like she was protecting not just my dad, but us from having this come out. It was a huge, unique event to have, her husband as well as, the father of her children come out as gay. And so I can appreciate that fact more because culture has changed a lot in that regard. But I didn't know. I did not grow up knowing that. I did not grow up talking about it easily. And I did not know anyone else in that situation, with the exception of my sisters, and especially as he became HIV positive and ill with AIDS. That was a very unique cultural kind of experience that my family had.
Can you talk about it's too big a question in a way, what that was like for you, but by that point, he lived in New York, right?
Yes.
And you had the experience of getting to know him a little bit there in this totally other realm because your interest in dance had also taken you to New York.
That's correct, yeah.
But you also, I think that, if I may, the other experience you had that may have helped you understand him more, other than just geographic proximity, is that you were in some way like a minority in a situation. You were the only white student at a dance school in Harlem.
Yes. So that was a really interesting experience for me. I spent a summer dancing at Dance Theater Harlem, and I am a white woman, girl then. So I very much felt other in that situation. But also part of my family dynamics is, you know, I have two sisters and one of them is adopted and she's black. So, you know, our family always, even without having a father around who was different, always, you know, attracted attention for people wouldn't questioned the fact that we were siblings because we don't look anything alike. And having an appreciation for feeling different and other did give me some empathy for my dad in that, because he did not talk about that. And it...
He didn't talk about being gay.
Not hardly, yes. And he definitely, it was not a point of, you know, some people at that time were involved in the pride movement. He lived in the city, you know, he could have been, and he didn't. And I think maybe it's possible that, you know, I internalized a little bit of shame from that whole thing of not talking about it. And I don't want that as a person. I don't want that as a writer. I don't want that for my family or our culture. So part of me writing the book is trying to, you know, break down some of those issues of stigma around homosexuality, around AIDS, around anything there can be. And I think, you know, again, referencing your earlier stories, how we can tell our personal stories. That's one way we can do that. And that's one way I hope to. And,
you know, I mentioned that you learned that your dad was gay without him being present. He didn't come out to you. You were in a family therapy session with your mom and your sisters. And those family therapy scenes, I've got to say, are amazing. And it's at Menninger's, right?
Yeah, Menninger's.
Menninger's, yeah. Mm-hmm. I always get that wrong. But this sort of also time capsule of family therapy in what I'm guessing early 80s?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you talk to me about that experience and what it was like to get that kind of information that way?
Yeah. You know, we were family therapy family. You know, we did that. And I did not like it at the time.
However, you have some quote that I can't remember the exact words, but I loved it. Like, in family therapy, someone will always notice that you're not talking.
Yeah. So I did not like it. However, I feel exceedingly grateful for it now as an adult. It really helped open things up for us. It might have been the only, you know, space where we could talk about hard things. And but it was not sort of this, we had teenage, it was all women, teenage girls sitting in there, you know, trying to be needled with questions that you didn't want to answer. That's how it felt at the time.
Yeah, like why there are holes in somebody's shoes.
Right. And, you know, feeling like you're getting picked on and that kind of thing. Yeah. But yeah, some of those were uncomfortable sort of to revisit memory-wise, but it helps me appreciate that family dynamics are complicated. I feel grateful that we had a third party that could sort of look at things, even if I felt at the time like it was horrible.
Your mom is such a force of a character. I mean, you've talked about that she had kept the information about your dad being gay quiet, and that reveals one side of her. But then there's this other side. You know, she's making dinner and telling you about, can you believe that women still don't get paid the same as men for the same work? And you jump in to ask, do they get paid more?
Yeah.
Can you talk about that scene and kind of your mom and what her political, I don't know, her spirit?
Yeah. So my mom is, she is an early women's libber. So that, and I write a little bit about that being sort of another way that we were different. There were a lot of two-parent families in my neighborhood growing up, and that was not the case in my home. And, you know, my mom really worked to pass the ERA, which, alas, did not pass. But so she's always been lefty and very liberal and willing to talk about it. But she's also not a complainer. And, you know, she got dealt with things that were not easy to deal with. And if something she modeled for me that I would want to, you know, model to my own children is to, you know, just press on, man, and not complain about it, but do your best. And she has always done that.
I love that scene because, and partly the way you write about it, that you, when you ask if they make more, and you write about how hard your mom laughed when you asked that question, but then you follow it up with that it, you actually were very surprised to hear this because your mom was the smartest person you knew.
Yeah, she is incredibly competent woman. She is smart, and like the fact that she would get paid less than a man would makes no sense now to me and didn't then either. So, yeah.
As you've referenced also, you know, you do have a sister who was adopted who is Black, and that you had a blended family racially. And I'm curious to hear if for you to share more detail about how that went down in Topeka in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, it was highly unusual. I know that in recent years you see more international adoptions. That makes it more common. But in my neighborhood, and definitely in Topeka, it was really unusual. And it just felt, at the time, it was just another way we were different. And I think, at least I'd like to think, that as a result, it's just given me a little bit of a heart for feeling that way about other people who, for some reason, don't fit in.
You know, when we talk about your dad's story, as I think it's becoming clear, really just one thread of this larger family tapestry, but an important one. And we just had World AIDS Day. And I wonder if that day brings up feelings for you about where we've come from culturally and politically and how we deal with AIDS or maybe don't deal with AIDS.
Well, definitely. I mean, so much has changed about the actual disease because of the medications that are available. And yet, you know, still there are pockets that pop up with increased incidences, and it is inevitably associated with, you know, some shame type that leads to increased incidence. And that's kind of heartbreaking to me, you know, when there are pockets that because of drug use, that, and that's been very recent that that happens, and it's completely preventable. And part of what happens is we don't want to talk about it, and we don't want to talk about shooting drugs. Young gay men have a higher, you know, incidence than other populations. And the less that we talk about it, the less we remember the stories of what's happened before, that the increase can happen. And that does bring up for me. And I've also been involved in an organization called the Recollectors, which is a community that remembers parents lost to AIDS, and they've been active in sharing personal stories, and I've been a part of that, and it's been wonderful because they're so diverse. This is not a disease that only affected gay men, and for those that were gay men, they left families, they left lots of people behind. So, yeah, World AIDS Day is a time when I really want everyone to pause and remember.
I know that getting to know your dad was a project for you. I mean, it was hard work to get to know him as much as you did. Is there one thing that you would like to share about him, something you learned in that process?
Well, I definitely have more empathy for him because he was really a witty, creative man who was trying the best he could.
Well, our time is up. Molly Krause, thanks so much for talking about your memoir, Float On.
Thank you for having me.
That's a wrap for today's show. You can hear anything we talked about today at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have it ready for you by the end of the day. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. And that's where you can also sign up to get these conversations sent to you, kind of like a podcast, on your own time. Tomorrow, we will talk to the first Black woman to play the Sugar Plum Fairy in the Kansas City Ballet's Nutcracker. Tune in for that conversation. We'll hear her story straight from her. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Sophia Gillespie. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.